Thanks everyone. Today we have Raphael from Carnegie Mellon. He's going to tell us about punk bicep in the early universe. We're going to have Raphael's run just for today. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go to lunch afterwards and have a speaker dinner at the bistro at 6:30.
Okay. Okay, thanks so much for the invitation. It's always nice to visit Perimeter. Initially, when I accepted the invitation for March, I actually thought I would be talking mostly about Planck and about the power spectrum measurement, because we've started looking at it again with David Spergel and René Losek. But the likelihood paper isn't out yet of the Planck team, so I guess I won't be talking about a reanalysis of it. And instead, we'll tell you a little bit about models of the early universe that we've been working on with various people and what we've been learning about them from the Planck data and BICEP. And I think everyone's seen these many times, but I thought I would start with a slide showing various CMB experiments just because they're very nice to look at. Obviously, there are the three satellites that everyone knows, the COBE, WMAP, and Planck. Then there are the ground-based experiments like AKPOL in the Atacama Desert, APPS, the Atacama Bimote Search, also in the Atacama Desert. Then the Polar Bear, also in the Atacama Desert for some reason. Then SPT Pole and BICEP 2 at the South Pole that everyone's seen. And then the balloon-borne experiments like EBEX and SPIDER, which launched recently around New Year and also has already finished taking data and also retrieved that data, and everything that seems to be working as advertised. So there's lots of CMB experiments going on, and I'm not even showing all of them. There's many that will start taking data soon. So it's a very active field, and it has taught us a lot about the early universe. I won't say much about it because most of you know these things, but obviously the data that one takes is not really CMB data, but it's just maps at different frequencies, and it contains information about much more than just the CMB. It contains information about the dust, the magnetic fields in the galaxy, reionization. Once you understand these, you can try to extract the parameters of the Lambda CDM model. You can learn about the properties of dark matter. And finally, also, which is what I'm usually interested in, the earliest moments of our universe. And what we've learned from these measurements in a fairly model-independent way for the primordial universe is that the perturbations that we see in the CMB existed before the hot Big Bang. By hot Big Bang, I really mean the moment when the universe was first filled with a very hot and dense plasma. These perturbations are nearly scale invariant, very close to adiabatic, very close to Gaussian, very close to adiabatic. And the question that everyone is trying to understand is what generated these perturbations. And they're really, at least if you assume that the geometry is weakly coupled, there are only really two scenarios. And I'll briefly explain that. I think most people know this as well. So if you look at the system of equations that describes the early universe, let's say for concreteness at temperatures below about 10 to the 9 Kelvin, but this is also true before then, so there are two important scales. One is the momentum of your mode, so you Fourier decompose all the perturbations, and you have the momentum of the mode, and you have the Hubble scale. And you see that if you look in the radiation-dominated era, Hubble redshifts like 1 over a squared. In the matter-dominated era, redshifts like 1 over a to the 3 halves. And the momenta redshift like 1 over a, so they redshift more slowly both in the matter-dominated era and the radiation-dominated era. And this means that the modes we observe today, obviously those are inside the horizon, so k over a is large compared to Hubble. If you run it backwards, these modes will eventually have momenta that are small compared to Hubble, so we call them super horizon modes. And this is nice on the one hand because the system of equation there becomes very simple and you can actually solve it analytically, but it's not so nice in the sense that if you want to generate these perturbations causally, they cannot have been a super horizon the whole time. So somehow you have to change this picture, you have to make sure that k over a grows more rapidly as you go back in time than h, or in terms of an equation, you have that you need a phase where d by dt of k over ah is less than zero. Here I'm putting the absolute values in because you could have a scenario where the universe is expanding, so you have a positive h, then what you have is d by dt of 1 over a dot, or a double dot has to be less than zero, or a double dot has to be positive, which means you have an accelerated expansion. This is what I'll refer to as inflation. It's a little bit too, so there's other scenarios in principle that we don't call inflation, but for now let me just call everything that has an accelerated expansion inflation. The other option is that you actually have a negative Hubble rate, so you have a contracting universe, and in this case the equation tells you that it has to be a decelerating phase. Now we know that we're not in a decelerating phase, contracting phase, because we see all the galaxies moving away from us. So we know that one way or another we have to come out on the other side, so the idea is you have a bounce. These are the two options. I think they're both interesting to explore. I typically work more on the inflationary side of things, and so I'll focus on inflation, but these are the two scenarios if you assume that the geometry is weakly coupled. And in principle, you can also give up a weakly coupled geometry, try to use holography, but I won't talk about that. So, yeah?
So, I mean, you could also play with the speed of sound. So, do you consider that part of this, one of these two? The speed
of
sound?
Yeah, technically, to be correct, it's not A and H that you have to compare with, right? If
yeah.
You have, for example, just radiation, phase transition to matter, then the radius that is important there is infinite and it collapses. So everything comes into the horizon, but the horizon is different from Hubble.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to really pinpoint this inflation, accelerator, and bounce, you have to go through the scales and amplitude.
Sure. I mean, this was really kind of a simplified version with CS equals 1 everywhere, if that's...
Right. I mean, sometimes you could say bounce is also an inflation, because at some point you have to inflate to go from contracting to expanding.
Well, but it's not what people usually call inflation. I mean, here really, the question is, when do you generate the perturbations? You can generate them during the decelerated contracting phase, or you can generate them during inflation.
This is how I'm distinguishing. Like the speed of sound.
Yeah, you can. I'm not right now including the speed of sound, but... Yeah, and so this is just, I think everyone has seen this diagram in various ways. Usually it's shown in different ways, I think. But here, this is how the diagram looks like for inflation. So you have a phase early on where you have a Hubble rate that's nearly constant. All the perturbations are generated as quantum fluctuations deep inside the horizon. The expansion of the universe stretches them out. They exit the horizon. They freeze out and eventually set the initial conditions for the system of equations that we solve in our codes, like CAM or CLASS or CMB-FAST or whichever one you like best. And then we just predict the CMB this way. So this is the standard picture for inflation that I'm sure people have seen. And also for this scenario, it's easy to compute the spectrum of scalar perturbations. And you know that it's nearly scale invariant, basically because of the symmetry of the spacetime, basically because the symmetry has an approximate isometry, the time translations of the sitter. Now, the question, or some of the interesting questions to consider, I think, are assuming inflation took place, what else can we learn about it beyond NS and the amplitude of the scalar perturbations? These are the things that I think we've essentially measured. So the question is, what else can you learn about it? And these questions, to me, are nice because, A, they tell us something fundamental about that period, but also because we might actually learn something about them in the next decade or so. The first question I'm listing here is, what is the energy scale of inflation? For a little while, when BICEP announced their result, we thought we knew, but now, again, we're back to not knowing what the energy scale is of inflation. But the way to look for it is to look for tensor modes. The other question that I'll say more about in a second is, how far did the inflaton actually travel? Other question you can ask. So both of these you would look for the answers by looking for tensor modes. Another question you can ask is whether there's only this one light degree of freedom, so just the inflaton, just the clock, or there are additional light degrees of freedom. This one you can look for by looking for a local non-Gaussianity, because there is a consistency condition that says that in the squeezed limit, in the absence of additional light degrees of freedom, you wouldn't see anything. The other thing you can look for is the propagation speed of the inflaton quanta. So this is the speed of sound that we just talked about, I guess, in the period of inflation. You might ask why you're interested in it, but the idea is really that by measuring the speed of sound, you can distinguish between different inflationary models. It's a bit like someone giving you two blocks of material. They're both black. You want to find out what the difference between is, so you start knocking on them or try to measure how fast the speed propagates in them. And this is something you can look for by looking for the equilateral types of non-Gaussianity. So let me briefly say a bit more about the energy scale of inflation. I think everyone, most people know this. So in addition to the scalar modes, inflation also predicts a nearly scale invariant spectrum of gravitational waves. The power spectrum looks like this. And in particular, you see the only thing it depends on is really the Hubble rate during inflation, which means you're really measuring the expansion rate of the universe, or using Einstein's equations, you can relate this to the energy scale of inflation. So you can write it the energy scale in this form. So it's the energy scale of inflation is 10 to the 16 GeV times the tensor to scalar ratio divided by 10 to the minus 2 to the 1 quarter. The 1 quarter really, I think, means that detecting it would be interesting. Putting upper limits is not so interesting. If we just put upper limits on R, the only thing we learn is that it didn't happen at the gut scale, but we won't really be able to push it significantly below the 10 to the 16. Detecting the perturbations would be exciting for many reasons. So this is that. And then the next question is how far the field actually traveled. And this goes back to papers by Leith and independently by Turner. These are from 1996. And the statement is that if you have a tensor to scalar ratio larger than 10 to the minus 2, which is roughly what we can observe, maybe we can go down to 10 to the minus 3 if you're more optimistic, maybe even 10 to the minus 4, but not parametrically more. But in any case, for these models, you learn that the field must have moved over a Planckian distance in field space. This is interesting if you're a field theorist, because the motion of a scalar field over a super Planckian distance is hard to control, at least in an effective field theory. And I'm trying to briefly explain why that is in this little toy example. So here, what you have is an effective field theory for two, for now just consider it in Minkowski space. So just some Minkowski space effective field theory for 2 degrees of freedom, phi and psi. And what you can look at is this vacuum. You see that you have one light degree of freedom, which is the phi field, one heavy degree of freedom, which is the psi field. You can integrate out the psi field and derive an effective field theory for the light guy for the phi field. And then what you get is, let's say we only care about the leading order and derivative, so we get a kinetic term for phi, and then we get a potential that looks like this. So they may have a constant piece, because we're starting looking at the system near the minimum. There's no linear piece, but then there's the quadratic piece, the mass term, maybe cubic interactions, quartic interactions, and then in principle there's all kinds of higher interactions. And these, typically, we don't know what these coefficients are, but they're usually order 1, and they're all suppressed by the cutoff, which typically is set by the mass of the heavy field that you've integrated out. And so as long as you move your field over a distance small compared to the cutoff, these terms are all negligible, and all you need are a handful of parameters. On the other hand, if you try to move it over a distance large compared to this cutoff, you see that you start to probe these coefficients, which you may not know. Now, you might say, well, maybe someone can compute them for me and just tell me what these coefficients are, and maybe then I can move my field over a distance large compared to the cutoff. But this is still not true, because the field doesn't only have self-couplings. It only had couplings to this other field, to the heavy fields that you've integrated out. And in particular, you might imagine having couplings that are phi squared, chi squared, or phi chi squared, or something like this. And then the VEF of order, the cutoff, will modify the masses of the heavy fields by an amount comparable to the cutoff. And in particular, some of the massive fields will drop, their masses will drop below the cutoff. If you had additional light fields, some of them would get pushed above the cutoff. So if you move a field over a distance large compared to the cutoff, typically you change the spectrum of your effective field theory completely. So you shouldn't expect to be able to move the field over a distance large compared to the cutoff. Now, you see there's an obvious way around this if you assume that the field has a shift symmetry, because then the field doesn't couple to the other degrees of freedom. The VEF doesn't influence their masses. You only have derivative couplings, and then all these problems that I just discussed are gone. The problem is that in this case, you just don't have a potential at all, so you either don't inflate at all or you inflate the whole time. So you have to do something about it, and you have to somehow break the shift symmetry in a controlled way. By a controlled way, I mean you want to add just a single operator which breaks the shift symmetry. Then quantum mechanically you will generate other operators, but you know that they must be small if the initial operator was small, because all these corrections would go away if you take the limit of zero mass in this case, let's say. And so one of the examples is Linde's chaotic inflation. He has a paper where he discusses it in these kind of terms, and the calculation, the relevant calculation, was actually done by Lee Smolin. So this is natural as long as the mass is much less than the Planck mass. Yes?
Planck 2015 doesn't favor m squared phi squared by
four. I'll get there. I'll get there, but this is just one example. So you'll see other examples that are still perfectly consistent with the data. So it is true that Planck now suggests that the potential flattens out relative to the phi squared potentials, but I think it hasn't yet ruled out monomial potentials. So something like phi to the 2/3 or linear potentials are still perfectly consistent with the data. And this was just an example that I think is familiar for someone looking at field theories, because it's just a free scalar field. But it's true that the data, and I think this is interesting about the current time, that we're about to actually rule out some of these models, like m squared phi squared. It looks like we're learning has nothing to do with our universe, which I think is interesting. And I'll have many, many plots on this. This was just a starting example. So I'm not claiming this is how the universe works. I'm just saying this is one model that follows this logic. So you have a field that in the absence of this term has a shift symmetry, and then you can add this term to break it.
Plateau model, you can do the same thing.
Yeah. I'm not advocating one model over the other. So you can have plateau models. I'm not saying you cannot have plateau models. This was just one example. Here's another example, which again is, I don't know. Is that okay? Or I'm not saying this is how the world works. This is just one example. Another example is natural inflation, which was proposed by Fries, Freeman, and Olinto. And the idea here is that the inflaton is an axion, and you use the typical non-perturbative potentials, so the sinusoidal potentials, to drive inflation. This is only consistent with the data for axion decay constants large compared to M Planck, which is, as I'll mention, is problematic in the context of string theory, but in principle, if you could arrange axion decay constants large compared to M Planck, you could look at a model like this, and you also see that in that limit, it more or less reproduces this. I mean, in the limit where you send f to infinity cap, keeping lambda to the 4 over f squared fixed and equal to m squared, these two models approach each other. Now, in field theory, if you're happy with the effective field theory, you can just postulate that such a symmetry exists, but it's not really obvious that these shift symmetries exist in a theory of quantum gravity. And in fact, the most naive implementation of an axion with an axion decay constant large compared to M Planck, which I mentioned on the previous slide, seems hard to realize in string theory. So there's a paper by Tom Banks, Dine, Fox, and Gorbato from 2003. There's also the gravity is the weakest force conjecture, which suggests that this shouldn't be possible. But there are, so this is true for single fields. Here, the idea is that you actually can align, if you have multiple axions, you can align them So you have an effective axion decay constant that's large compared to M Planck, which is, I think, something interesting to look at. But I think generally, all these things motivate a more systematic study of large field models of inflation in quantum gravity or string theory. I think it's really not obvious that such shift symmetries exist or that you can actually have large field models in the context of quantum gravity or string theory. And I'm not claiming this is something we've done, but we've tried to write some simple models, and I'll discuss one of them, which goes by the name of axion monodromy inflation. So in this case, this lives in the context of string theory and lives on a string theory compactified on a manifold where this is the four-dimensional spacetime and this is some internal six-dimensional spacetime. In this setting, the inflaton is an axion, as the name suggests, and the axions arise from integrating the gauge potentials that you have in the context of type 2B string theory, for example. You have the B2 field, or then you have C0, C2, and C4, and you can integrate them over the corresponding cycle. So you get an axion from integrating the B field over a 2-cycle, or the C field, the C2 over a 2-cycle, etc. And what you can show is by inspecting the vertex operators for these objects, you can see that they have a shift symmetry to all orders in G string and alpha prime, but they receive non-perturbative corrections to the potentials. Now, the corresponding canonically normalized scalar fields are periodic with period 2 pi f, where f is typically less than about 10 to the minus 1 M Planck. This is not a theorem, but it just happens in all the models that people have looked at, and typically the 0.1, you can trace it to something like the string coupling or something like this. There's no theorem as far as I can tell, and in principle, it looks from the models we had, these axion decay constants are proportional to intersection numbers. If you could come up with arbitrarily large intersection numbers, you could actually arrange it. So the statement that you cannot have F less than M Planck should actually translate into some theorem in math, which I'm not sure if that theorem exists or not. But so what people have done always gives axion decay constants less than, let's say, 0.1 M Planck. And so you get a picture so that you cannot use this directly to drive inflation. So the question is, how do you get out of it? And one way to get out of it is a mechanism called monodromy, which just means that you make the potential for the axion multivalued. So the potential then looks like this. So this excursion, so from here, if you look at the lowest branches, so you start here, going to here, this is sub-Planckian, but the potential is actually multivalued, and you can move up some metastable branch and travel over a distance large compared to M Planck. This is the idea. Monodromy, I should say, is not... Is this clear? I'm not sure if the picture, this illustration is very helpful. But okay, so this is the potential just becoming multivalued. You move along this metastable branch. You might ask to what extent you're tunneling down, but it turns out that because you're allowing the field to classically roll down, the classical rolling down is actually faster than the quantum tunneling, at least where we've checked this. Yeah?
So the constraint here at less than M Planck, that comes from demanding basically that the volume is larger than Planck scale, right?
Yeah, the string scale, I guess.
You could get above that, but you just won't be able to compute. It's just that the large M Planck regime is like, so part of the regime is your...
Yeah, and the idea is that then you really should be looking in a different... there's lots of dualities between different string compactifications, so the idea is you really should study it in a different... if you do it on a torus, let's say, you know that then you should use the T-dual description when the size of that thing becomes too small.
What does the
T-dual description tell you? For the torus, it would just then be the size then becoming larger. In the T-dual frame, it's actually, again, sub-stringy.
Right, so it remains sub-Planckian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the other frame that's weakly coupled, it's again sub-Planckian.
So in this model, what was the value correspond to? Is it like a distance or geometry or something?
What the inflaton is?
Yeah.
This depends a bit on the model. So in the model, I'll say it in a second what exactly we have in mind in the model I'm discussing. But in practice, for the model that's known as axion monodromy inflation, the axion arises from the C2 gauge potential. And from you have a two cycle in the internal six-dimensional manifold. From that two cycle, you get an axion by integrating the C2 over it. No, it just means that you could. So what's happening here is that as you move the axion out from the minimum, as you displace it from the minimum, you induce a certain amount of charge on. I haven't yet gotten to the relevant part, so maybe let me describe where the potential is coming from, and then I'll try to answer the question, just to make it coherent. But I'll try to explain it again. Just one point I wanted to make, that often people somehow think of this monodromy as something, some intrinsically stringy effect, and that's not really the case. So the monodromy occurs in various contexts. So you can look, for example, at just non-abelian gauge theories without, let's say, without any fermions. You look at large N Young-Mills theory, and you ask, what's the energy dependence of the energy on the value of the theta angle, and you find that this is actually multivalued. You also can look at the chiral Lagrangian and look at the dependence of the ground state energy on the theta angle, which is again multivalued. And in string theory, it happens generically for the axions in the presence of frames or also in the presence of fluxes. So here, the concrete example I want to give is for a D5 brain wrapping a two cycle. So in this case, what you should have in mind is the inflaton. This doesn't work for more technical reasons that I won't talk about, but the basic idea is the same as the one that's actually used in the model. But so here, what you're supposed to imagine, you have some six-dimensional compactification manifold. There's some two cycle. You get a axion from the integrating the B field over that two cycle. And then in the presence of a five brain that's wrapping that same two cycle, you get a potential that looks like this. So this is just the DBI action for the potential. And if you can work it out, and you just get an action that's the square root of L. This is the size of the two cycle in string units, plus B squared. And then in the limit where you take B large, this just becomes a linear potential. Now, also, this is a coupling that I didn't actually write, but to answer your question, as you move out the field, there's another coupling that tells you that as you move the axion away from the minimum, you actually induce a certain amount of three-brain charge on this five-brain. And this is what's caused. So this three-brain charge then carries sources flux. The flux carries energy density. So the further you move it out, the higher you move up on the branch. And in principle, you can discharge it by discharging the units of three-brain charge in this. So this is the picture. Somewhat as a comic book version of this picture is the model lives on type 2B orient defaults with O3, O7 planes. The moduli are stabilized as in the KKLT construction. So you can ask to what extent you trust it or don't trust it. I don't know. It depends on the person. But the idea is that the complex structure moduli and the dilaton are stabilized using fluxes. The Keller moduli are stabilized using non-perturbative effects like Gaugino condensation. And then the geometry is supposed to look like this. So you're supposed to have some six-dimensional geometry, and then a building block that looks like this. So you have a throat sticking out of that geometry, and you have the throat bifurcating into two subthroats, and you have an NS5 in one of these little subthroats, an anti-NS5 in the other subthroat, and then you have a one-parameter family of two cycles that they're both wrapping for to cancel the tadpole. Now, the reason the geometry is supposed to look like this has to do with back reaction. which I won't discuss in detail. And also, just to give you an idea of where we stand with these kind of geometries, we don't really have, certainly don't have a compact geometry that has anything like this. And we also don't have a very good local geometry that looks like this. There are certain approximations to these geometries that we have and that all the estimates are based on. But I think there's room for improvement in terms of these models. So we're not sure how it, so the concrete realization, one concrete realization is you look at the Klebanov-Strassler solution, which is just not compact, and you don't know how the thing glues in, but you can look at the throat, and then what you can do is you can orbifold it, so you get a line of fixed points, and then you can blow up those fixed points. Those fixed points would give you, the blown up version of them are supposed to be this one parameter family of two cycles. Another yeah, it's not totally clear that you really don't care about it at the end of the day because the energy scales are not so far separated. The inflationary energy scale in these models is relatively high, so that I think there is stuff to be understood. So other geometries you can use is the warped resolved conifold by Klebanov and Morgan. On that one, you can actually put stacks of you can actually achieve this bifurcation, for example. So this is the explicit version where we have this bifurcated little throat, but they're all not glued into anything at the top. And these were written down mostly as an existence proof for models around the time the white papers for the CMB pole satellite were written, because there were claims that detecting tensor modes would actually rule out string theory, and so the idea was that one should write a paper showing that that's not the case. But this is why one doesn't feel so bad about having a Baroque model like this, because it was meant as an existence proof. By now, I think they're slightly better, it's become clear that this is really more generic, and there's a larger class of these models with potentials that still have monomial forms, and so far the models that people have realized in practice, P goes like so phi to the 2/3, or a linear potential, or phi to the 4/3. I think there's also phi to the 5/8 at some point. There's phi squared, phi cubed, and so on. And I think it should be clear that these are just the ones that people have realized, and you can presumably interpolate and essentially realize any P between 0 and some power, maybe 3 here, but 4 is really the, well, anyway. Now, you might say that if we see phi squared, which it doesn't seem like we do, you probably wouldn't believe all this gymnastics, so it would be nice if these models actually made additional predictions, and they do make some additional predictions. The additional predictions are that there's instanton corrections in this little geometry that I drew. For example, you can have Euclidean D1s that wrap this family of two cycles as well, and they lead to oscillatory contributions in the potential that look like this. And these lead to oscillatory contributions in the power spectrum that one can look for. And this is something one can also work out for this larger class of models, and one finds that the potential looks like this. So you have the phi to the p, a piece of the potential, the slow roll part of the potential, and then small oscillations. It turns out that it's not always a cosine of phi in here, but the frequency, if you want, you can think of it as the frequency drifting, the axion decay constant drifting. The reason for this is that the axion decay constant is set by the volumes of the two cycles in the internal geometry, and as inflation goes on, the volume of these two cycles changes a little bit, and so the axion decay constant changes, and meaning that the effective frequency changes. When the models were first written down, it was for WMAP, where the dynamic range is not that large, and it was perfectly okay to ignore this and set this to zero, the PF equals zero, so you just have cosine phi over F. But even for Planck, one really should include the effect that the phase, the frequency can drift just because you have a larger range of scales that you're probing. Delta phi is just some phase that in principle is calculable, but usually one doesn't keep track of. And then also the amplitude of these oscillations actually depends on the inflaton itself. I should also say that these are typically exponentially sensitive to the volumes of cycles in the internal geometry. And if these cycles are large in string units, this means they're exponentially small. So you have to be somewhat lucky to actually see these oscillations. Once you have the potential, you can just go through the same exercises that we did in the monodromy paper for the linear potential, work out the power spectrum, and not too surprisingly, there's a power spectrum that looks like this. So you have this low roll piece, and then you have some oscillatory contributions, and you can work out the amplitudes, and you can work out the amount of drift in terms of some of the underlying features of the potential.
So these models are much more in data.
Yeah.
I think in practice, people usually assume that the oscillatory part of the power spectrum is just perfectly oscillatory and log k, but you're saying there should be some.
Yeah, this is that's what I'm showing. So the analysis we did doesn't assume that. So we're actually specifically looking for things that include a drift. And this was also done by, so this is what we wrote, I mean, motivated. So we were asked, I guess, we were interested in it, but also people like Hiranya was interested in it for the Planck analysis. And so we wrote the paper that these plots are from in December, specifically looking for this. This is also why we derived all these analytic forms for the power spectrum. Once you have these analytic forms, it's relatively easy to constrain them. And this is what I'm showing here. So this is really a search for oscillations with the template that I have on the previous slide. And what I'm showing here are each dot represents an improvement over a lambda CDM of at least 4. And the larger the dot gets and the bluer, the larger the improvement, it goes up to an improvement of delta chi squared of around 18 in these plots. And then here, these are more or less constant frequencies at the end of the day, these lines. And really the drift only becomes, which makes sense, so the drift only becomes interesting or important when the frequency is high. If you only have one oscillation across the whole CMB spectrum, the drift is not really something you would detect. At high frequencies, you actually start being sensitive to the drift. And also this was mostly, and the range here was mostly chosen based on our computational limitations at the time, but we'll do a more complete search. So this was some preliminary runs, and they were done with the likelihood code from Planck that was public, and then the likelihood code I'll briefly describe in a little bit that we made with David and Renee. And you see that some of the features actually stay the same. So there are some frequencies that you see in both of them, but quite a few of them really are only there in one of the likelihoods, which clearly means that they're not primordial. There's some noise. This is the oscillations. So this was in the nominal mission data. This was our search for the nominal mission data in December. And obviously at the time, Planck was already working with the full mission data. And you see the results of these searches for the full mission data here. They look essentially the same. So this line is still here, and then some of these lines just really are exactly the same frequencies. So you might ask, well, what do these improvements mean? So you get a delta chi squared of up to 18, is what I said, but but you also expect to get some amount of improvement, but if you fit some oscillatory power spectrum to a noisy data. So what I did to understand it is to just do simulations and do the same fit to simulations. And you see that in the absence of a signal, you expect an improvement of 16.5 plus minus 3.5, which is essentially the same as 18. So really, it looks like there's nothing there. One should keep in mind, I think, that we haven't really searched the entire parameter space, and we're still working on it. One can also imagine, we also haven't looked for the drift in the amplitude. There's a number of things that we haven't yet done, and that we're still working on it. But as of now, at least, there's no evidence for oscillations in the primordial power spectrum from the data. Also, this is something I already stressed. So this amplitude is very, very model dependent. And if you don't see them, it doesn't really rule out the models. But if we don't see them now, I guess it really means we're stuck with looking for other things like NS and R until we look in other data sets. So large-scale structure surveys for example, should be able to improve these constraints significantly in the near future. Yeah?
So the drift of the oscillations here is presumably some modulus field of all them as well. Does that mean that you get some, so it's like a quasi one field model, so you get some enhanced non-Gaussianity or as a curvature or something?
The non-Gaussianity you can actually compute. We haven't yet really looked for it, but it's still effectively a single field model, so there's no other light degree of freedom. It's just something that adjusts adiabatically as inflation goes on. So at least in the regime we've been looking, there is non-Gaussianity, but it's quite similar. It's the resonant type non-Gaussianity is the most important contribution in these models, again, from the oscillations.
I'm just sort of curious, if you know what was driving this difference between M spectrum, cross spectrum, high spectrum, kind of large, is it like that?
I'm not totally sure I did plots of chi-squared broken up into L. And then you can ask where the improvement is coming from. And it's coming from here around between like L of 600 and L of 800 is one contribution. It's a plot that's in the paper with Richard Easter, I guess, from a while ago. So there's some improvement from around L of 800, 600 to 800. And then there's another contribution that only comes from 217 gigahertz, which suggests you probably shouldn't worry about it too much. But so some of the contribution comes at all frequencies between 6 and 800, and then some of it comes from the 217 gigahertz data around 1500 and then 1800. 1800 is the region of the cooler line, so some of it has to do with the cooler line, not all of it. And the fact that it's still there means here it's still there in the full mission data, which shouldn't have the cooler line because it's based on half mission cross spectra. And so it's worth looking at again. There's no relevant plot in the Planck paper. There's a plot only showing the residuals, so the spectrum minus the best fit model. But it's a bit hard to see by eye exactly what that means as to where the improvement is coming from. I think it's still coming from around 600 to 800. There's some differences in the residuals that I found online in the plots by Elsner, in the residuals that were shown for the oscillatory fit, but I don't know exactly.
If we don't ever detect or see our oscillations, what's the status of falsifying or verifying the equation? Because n is fixed by assuming.
So, I think that's the question better for the end, because I think it's like an open ended one.
Maybe this is not
Yeah, I'll also say a lot more about NS and R now, I guess, motivated by the fact that we're kind of stuck with it. And so the last part will be about R. But yeah, it's not so clear, I would say, what the right answer to that is. So yeah, I'll now say a little bit more about the measurements of NS and R. Some of it was based on the analysis that I've already mentioned with David and Renee. And some of it is based on the analysis that we did with also David and Colin and also Aurelien Frase. And the first part I'll discuss is the measurement of the power spectrum, so the NS. This is based on the Planck temperature anisotropies. Then I'll also talk a little bit about the BICEP power spectrum and the Planck B-mode power spectrum. Now, just to remind you how the Planck power spectrum is actually measured, there's three parts to the likelihood. I will only really describe the one that is for the multiples larger than 50, which is known as CAMSPEC. And the ingredients for this part of the likelihood are the 100 gigahertz maps from HFI, 143 gigahertz maps, and 217 gigahertz maps. The detectors, and it uses detector set spectra. So And this, I should say, is in case you haven't been looking at this, but this is the 2013 analysis. So right now, I'm not talking about any of the new results. This is all still the nominal mission data. And it uses the detector set spectra. Detector set spectra means for every detector set, you make a map, and then you cross-correlate those maps. For 100 gigahertz, they used up to L of 1200. I won't discuss in detail why these ranges are chosen, but if anyone is interested, I can show plots explaining why that is after the talk, I guess. The 143 gigahertz detector set spectra are used up to 2000. And so the reason the ranges are going up is just because the resolution is getting better. So it's 10 arc minutes, 7 arc minutes, 5 arc minutes. And then 143 cross 217 and 217 cross 217 are used up to 2500 and starting at L of 500. The lower Ls are not used because of galactic emission in this case. Now, what you have to do, obviously, because you see a lot of galaxy everywhere, is you have to mask the galaxy. These are the masks that were used in the 2013 analysis. Now the masks are much more aggressive. But here you see that so the black stuff is thrown out, the white stuff is kept, and you see there's very conservative masks that were used. Despite the fact that you mask a lot of the sky, you still have to subtract the diffuse galactic emission in these regions for the 143 and 217 gigahertz spectra. And of course, you have to model the extragalactic foregrounds. I won't say much about the approximations to the likelihood, but it's really just a Gaussian, a chi-square type likelihood. Now, there's a number of reasons, I think, to look at the measurement independently from the Planck collaboration. One is just that even though it's a big collaboration, each individual experiment is done by a relatively small number of people, so I think it's useful to have extra set of eyes looking at it. But there were also questions or reasons to look at it based on plots that were shown in the Planck publications. One of them I'm showing here, this is a plot that I was interested in because I'm coming from the inflationary side, and I was interested in NS, and you see that depending on the data you include, NS actually shifts by about a sigma, so you see that if you take out the 217 gigahertz data, NS shifts from about 0.96 to 0.97, and the question is, why is this? It doesn't mean there's anything wrong, of course, because, as I said, the 217 gigahertz maps have the highest resolution, so it's perfectly possible that the new information you're adding on small scales actually pulls NS down. So it could be that, or it could be that there's something going on. Something else that was interesting was just making a plot of the spectra. So here I'm showing something like L to the 4 CL, and these are the spectra that go in. Orange is a little hard to see because it's underneath everyone else, but the orange crosses are the 100 gigahertz spectra. The red ones are 143 gigahertz spectra. The green ones are the 143 cross 217 cross spectra, and the blue ones are the 217 gigahertz spectra. And one thing you see is that the foregrounds at 217 gigahertz are significant. It's larger than at all the other frequencies. And you also see that the data is hanging low here. And I'll say a bit more about that. And then it's systematically looks somewhat high here. So these are some of the other things that you just notice when you look at the spectra. Additional motivation was provided by the null tests that were shown by the Planck collaboration. There's the measurement of the spectra for survey 2 minus survey 1. The CMB should cancel out in this difference, so it should be consistent with 0, but you saw that some of the 217 gigahertz spectra were not consistent with 0. It's not a huge failure of the null test, so one probably shouldn't overestimate the significance of this, but in any case, what was interesting is that here you see it for one set of detector set spectra, but in the paper, it was stated that the only other cross spectra that failed is are this one and this one, which are also all at 217 gigahertz. So we were wondering if there's anything interesting at 217 gigahertz, and we thought one simple way of checking is to just use the Planck covariance matrix. So the likelihood is Gaussian, so you just have a covariance matrix, and you can compute a conditional probability for measuring 217 gigahertz given the measurement at 100 gigahertz, 143, and 143 cross 217. And you can use this probability to predict the expectation value for 217 cross 217. So this is what you expect to find given these measurements. And then you can compare it to what you actually find. And if you look on large scales, you find that L by L, really the prediction and the measurement agree remarkably well. So the red and the blue dots are essentially always on top of each other, which is good. But then as you go to smaller scales, you see that there is something happening around 1800, which we also saw in the previous plot. And then you also see here, so red, I should say, is the prediction with one sigma error bars, and blue is the measurement. And you see that there's the measured 217 gigahertz spectra are low here and are somewhat high here. It's understood now what these systematics are. So this is what is known as the 4K cooler line. It's not really the cooler line, but it's what's left over once you try to remove the cooler line. And so the idea is that the cooler vibrates at 10 hertz, 20 hertz, 30 hertz. The frequency isn't always quite the same, so it drifts around a little bit. The satellite spins around its axis at around one round per minute. And so if you have something that's in resonance with this at 10 hertz, you imprint something at L of 600. If you have something at 20 hertz, it imprints something at 1200. And then the 30 hertz cooler line imprints something at 1800. This was known by Planck. There was an attempt to remove this interference between the 4K cooler and the readout electronics. And there was some glitch in the cooler line removal, which causes this. Then here, there's two effects, actually, that lead to this excess. One was there was a bug in the way the beams were assigned to the different detector sets at 217 gigahertz, so just an indexing bug in the code. The other thing that is happening is that you're correlating things that are happening on the spacecraft at the same time, and you can have correlated noise between the different detectors. So if a cosmic ray hits, or the cooler just leads to correlated noise between the detectors, which gives you this excess out here. So this is, I think everyone agrees now on these kind of, that there were these systematics in the spectra. Here I'm just showing in a more quantitative way the amount of disagreement. So I had this conditional probability. It looks like e to the minus 1/2 chi squared, and I can plot the chi squared. I have 2,000 degrees of freedom. So this is where I expect the measurement to come out, and it comes out around here, which is, I think, something like 9 sigma discrepant. The reason that this doesn't affect cosmological parameters all that much is that it's hard to actually fit a dip like this in the context of lambda CDM. Now, these considerations motivated us to clean the spectra with either 353 gigahertz or 545 gigahertz. Actually, what we do is use both of them. So you clean one of the maps with 353 gigahertz, the other one with 545 gigahertz, and you cross-correlate them. Then you clean this one with 545, this one with 353, and cross-correlate them. This avoids correlating the 353 gigahertz detectors with each other and the 545 gigahertz detectors with each other. Here, what I'm showing is just the cleaning with 545 gigahertz. So this is the uncleaned map, and this is the cleaned map. And by eye, you see it looks much nicer. Obviously, one has to be careful. But in these strips, in case you're wondering, is just because not the full sky is observed in a given 6 months period in Planck. So there's some missing pixels for each of the surveys. Now, also, what we do is we use the survey maps rather than the detector sets. Partly this is because the detector set maps just were not made public at the time. But the other reason is that you want to avoid the systematics where things happen to different detectors at the same time, and you want to instead correlate things that happen in the first 6 months with things that happen in the second 6 months. This also has systematics, but we think they're less than the systematics introduced by correlating the detector sets. For the covariance matrix, we used the same approximations as in CAMSPEC. We had to specify the masks, the noise, and the cleaning procedure. The masks are shown here. So this is the analog of the Planck masks. In addition to the pixels that were masked by Planck, because we're using survey crosses, we have to mask these kind of strips. And then there's also other missing pixels that one has to mask. This is the masks that are the closest to the ones in the Planck analysis. And then these ones are the ones that we used in the analysis that we actually report in the paper, or the parameters that we report. And you see that the advantages that the cleaning, so we found that the cleaning and foreground modeling really give the same answers in terms of cosmological parameters, but the cleaning allows you to use more sky. So this is one reason why we thought the cleaning was nice. The noise you probably don't care about. You can measure it from the survey differences. The cleaning I already briefly described. We've really used various cleaning algorithms and also a large range of masks, different ways of apodizing the masks, and it, just to test that everything is consistent. We didn't see any shifts. I'll show that in a more quantitative way. In addition to our cleaned analyses, we've also performed the same analysis that the Planck team performed with modeling the foregrounds at the power spectrum level. And we didn't really find a dependence on the masks or on the treatment of foregrounds. So it's perfectly fine to either clean or model the foregrounds. And here it's in a more quantitative way. So this was the Planck cosmology that was reported, shown as omega matter versus NS, just because it shows the shifts relatively clearly, and then H naught versus omega matter. And you see the Planck measurement comes out here. If you use the Planck data, take out 217 gigahertz, it comes out here. And these are all the various ways of cleaning. So this is the mask I just showed you. It has an F-sky of 47%. It's this hybrid cleaning based on 353 gigahertz and 545 gigahertz. Comes out here. And then these are different sky cuts. So this one has a F-sky of 50%. This guy is the 353 gigahertz cleaning. This one is again a different cleaning. And so you see that all these things come out relatively close to the analysis for Planck without the 217 gigahertz. Now you might ask, where exactly is the new Planck analysis coming out? And the analogous thing wasn't given. There's different analyses now. The closest one, I actually didn't show, but it comes out around here. So there's a measurement that the Planck measurement comes out around here. And the lesson for us was that the foreground model actually worked well. So there were no issues with the foregrounds, but there were some systematics in the detector set maps, and we argued that the systematics are smaller in the survey crosses, and the new analysis is based on half-mission cross spectra. So I think we largely all agree. Oh, this is the plot I was just looking for. I put it in the wrong place. But this is where the new Planck analysis based on the 2013 data comes out, which is relatively close also to this. And so I think as far as NS goes, everyone agrees that NS actually shifted up a little bit. One should also keep in mind in the parameters that are being quoted in the paper that tau actually shifted down, and tau and NS are degenerate. So if we rerun our analysis with the lower value of the optical depth, we find that NS is 0.965 and H naught is 67.5, let's say. So all these things that are interesting in the Planck papers are still interesting, I think. I mean, the H naught inferred from the CMB data seems to be much lower than the H naught measured from local measurements, like the Ries et al. Paper, also George Estathius reanalysis, also the Humphreys paper after that. So I think this is something interesting to keep in mind. I don't know what to make of it, but I think it's an interesting tension.
Did you just take the prior on the optical depth there because you don't have the Planck polarization to do it yourself? So you just took the 2015 polarization prior and do that?
Yeah. Effectively, that part of the likelihood really just acts as a prior on tau. It doesn't really do much else because it's very low L information. It doesn't do much other than put a prior on tau. Okay, and then this is from the Planck 2015 analysis, and this is what was mentioned earlier, that M squared phi squared, I guess, is now not looking so good anymore. But there's still the model. So this is the model with the linear potential that I described. This is one thing that you can, for example, realize in these stringy models. And it's still looking OK. So I think the chaotic type inflation models are not being ruled out. But it's true that we're learning that phi squared is not a particularly good fit. And certainly phi to the fourth, phi cubed, are definitely ruled out by now. And also phi squared, I don't think it's phi squared. But we'll see. So now BICEP, so let's look in this direction again a bit more, I guess, in the R constraint. BICEP, everyone's seen the picture. I just included it because I think it's a nice picture with BICEP2 over here, SBT, and then Keck array. just 200 meters off to the side. This plot, I think also everyone has seen. It's bicep 1 here, bicep 2, Keck array. The interesting thing in this direction is that what happened is that the detectors can now be mass produced, so you can put more and more detectors in the focal plane, which is a big step forward. The other reason to show it is because Keck array, I wanted to point out that Keck array now installed 220 gigahertz receivers over the break, and also bicep 3 was actually installed over the Christmas break. So this is all going according to plan, which is exciting, I think. This is what the data looked like. Everyone's seen these maps. The E modes were consistent with what was expected from the simulations. The B modes were not consistent with what was expected from the simulations. The maps are really nice. They're the maps with the lowest noise levels we have at 150 gigahertz. For comparison, so these are 87 nanokelvin degree. Planck noise levels are a few microkelvin degrees. So these are really much deeper maps than the Planck maps. And this was the power spectrum that everyone's also seen. The question is, what is it? Is it in the sky? I think everyone by now agrees that it's probably in the sky. I mean, maybe there's some small amount of systematics, but not the whole thing certainly doesn't seem like it's all systematics. So the question was, is it foregrounds or is it cosmological? And these were the estimates that were presented by the BICEP team. I won't go through them. If anyone's interested in these models, I can say more about it, but these plots were the reason why BICEP concluded that it has to be cosmological, just because their foreground models were all much lower than the measurement. For me, the problem was that there's no error bars on these lines, so I started making, I'm interested in the inflationary model, so I wanted to make a likelihood that includes both the dust and the CMB contribution, so I can get an idea how large the tensor to scalar ratio is. And as I started doing that, all the estimates came out high. So here are some of these estimates that I showed. These were made with David, Colin, and Aurelian. And you see that they all came out high, all consistent with each other, all consistently high. Then the interesting thing to me, amusing thing, was that in my talk, I criticized this model because I thought it was really the only physical model. All the other ones were done without any information from Planck, so just no relevant information, essentially just models. And the result was that the published version now has just this model removed, which is a little ironic to me. It's what I did in the paper. In the paper, we actually discuss all of them, but in the talk, I didn't. And then, yeah, no one reads the paper. That's... That's the conclusion. So here, I guess I am criticizing the other ones too, but I don't want to criticize the models because I think it's actually quite good that you get within a factor of 2 without knowing anything about that patch of the sky. So I think the models actually did a good job. But already at the time when the papers were written, one could have known that these models don't really predict the sky all that well, because what you can do is you have, so what BICEP had is was a digitized map of the Planck data, the Planck polarization fraction. If you just plot that, this is the histogram you get. It looks like this. And you could compare it to some of the histograms made from these models. And then you see, so this, the blue one is the Planck sky model. This is the logarithmic spiral R model. This is the bisymmetric spiral. And you see that none of them really look at all like the actual sky. And so it shouldn't be surprising. I don't know. So in any case, the measurement then at 353 gigahertz was interesting. Mine, it used things I probably shouldn't discuss. But if anyone's interested in exactly how the measurement was done, I'm happy to discuss it. But it's consistent in any case with the measurement that was done by and reported by the Planck collaboration. One thing that was curious to me when I saw it is the binning here. That seemed like a political choice because clearly you could have shown everyone what the shape looks like there. If you combine them, you get an upper limit of R is less than 0.12 just from there.
What is the political advantage of not showing the shape? I don't get it.
I think the idea was that if it looks like this, it looks worse for bicep than if it actually looks like. So what you expect from the dust is that it goes like L to the minus 0.4. This is what you would have expected if it's like a typical high latitude patch, and it should have been rising. And if you look at the measurements now, when they don't pin it, it doesn't really rise in that patch. It just does not look like L to the minus 0.4. And it looks a lot like this, so it looks kind of bump-like, just like the measurement from bicep. Here you can see it. It doesn't rise. So these are different. Some of them are detector set maps. Some of them are either year, half mission, whatnot. But it just doesn't. It's not rising as you go to large scales. Not just in that patch. I mean, that patch just does not look like the average high latitude region in the sky. And there should be some scatter, right? It's not surprising, I think, that not all patches look the same. I mean, a clean patch of sky, dirty patch of the sky, they don't really have to all look the same. So these are just the spectra that go into the bicep Keck cross Planck likelihood, the 150 gigahertz spectra that we've all seen. Then this is the cross spectrum of 150 gigahertz with 217. Then the cross spectrum with the dust, so there's clearly a cross correlation between the bicep and Keck maps and the dust maps from Planck. And then this is the auto spectrum. And these were the likelihoods that you got out. And you see that depending exactly on what you use, if you use just the bicep data or bicep plus Keck or Keck, you find slightly different numbers, but I think in any case, you should really read this as an upper limit. There's a number of reasons why I would argue you should really only read this as an upper limit, and this is also how the paper was written, so I think there's nothing really much to argue about. One thing that was also shown in the paper was instead of doing this foreground modeling, you can clean the maps or the spectra. So you can look at the bicep Keck power spectrum minus alpha times bicep Keck cross Planck. And this is shown, so this black one is the unclean power spectrum, the blue one is the clean power spectrum, and you see there's, if you squint, maybe there's a little bump here, but it's really not really significant, and this is what's reflected in the posterior for the measurement on R. One thing I was wondering when I saw this plot, in all the previous plots they showed us bicep Keck, also bicep and Keck separately, here they only showed us bicep Keck. So one plot I just made out of curiosity is the one for Keck alone, and you see there's just absolutely no bump anywhere, and it looks very consistent with the lensing, which is a bit depressing, but it may be just what it is.
Why wouldn't it, if there was gravitational waves, it would be also at higher frequencies, so why wouldn't it subtract gravitational waves as well?
Well, because of the frequency dependence. So the CMB has a very different frequency dependence from the dust. The dust rises as you go to 353 gigahertz. The CMB peaks at 150 or so gigahertz and then drops.
So you just feed for it. That's a frequency dependence. Yeah.
But this keeps the CMB fixed. So this linear combination, the 1 minus alpha divided by 1 minus alpha, this is what the 1 minus alpha is for. It keeps the CMB contribution fixed.
Perfect.
So you take a linear combination that keeps the CMB fixed and minimizes whatever else is in the map. And then, so this is what happens when you just combine all the various measurements. And again, so this is the new bound, which is R is less than, I didn't write it anywhere, but it's less than 0.09. And again, this favors the phi squared models. You can still have these models, the phi or the phi to the 2/3. So these models are not ruled out. Maybe they will be ruled out, but right now they're not ruled out. There's also Sterbinsky's model somewhere down there. You can have plateau type models. I think we'll, for now, just need more data. One plot that I wanted to show is something that just shows the amount of experimental progress, just so it's not a... which I think is interesting. So with the current data, you can constrain R in two different ways. One is the tensors contribute to the temperature anisotropies on large angular scales, and the B-mode polarization. So these are two different contributions. The likelihood statistically are essentially independent, so the joint likelihood we usually write is this likelihood with R, the tensor contribution to the temperature, and B modes being the same. So this is what we usually look at, but you can look at the likelihoods independently, so in this way as a two-dimensional thing. And then the situation before March looked like this. So the bounds on the tensors from temperature are shown on this axis, and these are the bounds on the B-mode polarization. And at the time, the upper limit was R is less than 0.7 from the BICEP1 experiment. And then after March, obviously the temperature piece didn't change, but the constraints from the B-mode polarization went down by a factor of 7. And soon there's more and more data, so soon the constraints from the B-mode polarization will be significantly better than the ones on T. And so the experimental progress actually was huge. So BICEP2 reduced the size of the error bars by a factor of 7 from pre-March to post-March. To conclude, I think as everyone knows, the BICEP2, Keck, and Planck data currently provide no evidence for primordial gravitational waves. The simplest model of inflation, by which I mean m squared phi squared, is currently disfavored at 2 to 3 sigma, depending a bit on the details of the analysis. I think it'll be very interesting to have the Keck array 95 gigahertz data, which should be out sometime late spring or early summer. I think this will be exciting because it's a map of comparable quality to the BICEP2 maps, and we will be able to do a lot more with it. Not so much we, because they're not public, but the collaboration. And then over the course of the decade, over the next few years, the limit should go down to, let's say, 10 to the minus 2. And then over the course of the decade, the experiments will push it to 10 to the minus 3. Or, of course, if the signal is larger, we should eventually see something, which would be exciting. Now, for many other questions, I think large-scale structure will be the next frontier. And for me, I hope that there will be some dedicated experiments dedicated to understanding the early universe. One proposal that I think was discussed here at a meeting, I guess, it was the Spherix proposal by Olivier and company. And on the theory side, I hope that things will also be eventful and we'll learn more about the early universe as all the data improves. And that's all I have to say for now. So, thanks. Yeah.
So coming back to the first part of the talk, if you just take it seriously for a second, this other model that wiggles is a better fit. You argue that the look elsewhere effect says you should take it seriously.
So yeah.
Where would those wiggles appear in the matter power spectrum?
In the matter power spectrum, so these oscillations are to a good approximation, like Kendrick said, in log K. So they're everywhere and in log K. Also, if you look at the correlation function, there's also oscillations in log of. Yeah, so they're. Well, they're just in the power spectrum, it's relatively easy to visualize. You just have a higher frequency for low K. And then as you go to higher K, it becomes slower and slower. It's just a log. They're the same amount of oscillations per decade.
If you want. So what's the lowest?
Yeah, they're at all K.
I need to see a picture.
Maybe we would say they show up at the highest case measures, or the most signal highest case measures, if you look at KQ. The fact that I don't think anyone's calculated is like the same large scale displacements that smooth out the AM would smooth out these oscillations in large scale structure.
Sorry, what? The same what that smooths out the AM?
Well, you know how the AM people smooth out.
Velocities,
you know,
regis spacing.
Yeah. So I guess that finding the statistical weight in K increases as KQ for a while, and then it starts to exponentially suppress. The peak is somewhere around like 0.1 because the denominator is large scale spacings are about 10.
Of course, with some reconstruction, you can undo much.
Yeah, reconstruction probably helps a lot.
Well, then they have potential 5. Couple of the vanishes. So this says something about
Yeah. But this, yes? No, not so much. I mean, it just is where people usually draw this line of convex or not. I mean, yeah, no. Also, I mean, it's very close to linear, but it's not exactly linear. So the potential really is something like square root of 1 plus phi squared. So it's just very close to linear at large field values.
So that's what you mean when you say that models of inflation kind of follow that line need more than one parameter. It's like they need more than one parameter to complete the potential in the IR and surrounding inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what
so
I mean.
As you go away from the large phi limit, there's all these extra terms. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, it just tells you where.
Do they have a minimum?
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how you feel about an extra parameter. Different people feel differently about having an extra parameter in your theory. But I think that that's kind of what the data is telling us, that there is an additional parameter.
Come back to my open question.
Uh-huh.
It's been skepticism raised by inflation.
Yeah.
So, taking a pessimistic point of view, you keep trying to down that. I don't see primordial gravitational waves,
mm-hmm.
no oscillations or whatever. We're stuck with S of S.
Yeah, I think if we don't see anything, it will be difficult to distinguish between inflation and anything else that gives the same spectrum of perturbations with the same properties, nearly scale invariant, nearly Gaussian, nearly adiabatic. It will be very difficult to distinguish in a convincing way, I think. So it would be nice if we saw something. If we don't see anything, I right now don't have a good idea what to look for. You can try looking for things like the running and try to go after the predictions there. You can try going for, in principle, you can keep looking in non-Gaussianity, depending a bit on how confident you are. You might hope that you can eventually detect the equilateral part of the prediction for single fields Laurel. It's a bit futuristic, but in principle, there are still observables one can go after, just not with the current data sets. But the three-point function, I think one could still look for. Just I'm not sure how to do it right now in practice.
All right. And the survivors, thank you.